Hello, and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and archived, eventually, permanently, at alexlinder.com. Today we're going to do Libido Dominandi, Sexual Liberation and Political Control by E. Michael Jones of culturewars.com, published 2000, St. Augustine's Press, out of South Bend, Indiana. That's where Notre Dame is. We're going to do Part 3, Chapter 19, Evansville, Indiana, 1981. It's about 13, 14 pages as we draw ever closer to the end of this tome. So Evansville, Indiana, 1981 is where this takes place, at least some of it. When Tom Schiro, S-C-H-I-R-O, awoke on the morning of February 4th, 1981, he knew that something was wrong. Schiro had been working since November as a temporary employee of Tri-State Repair, helping to renovate the company's building at 1201 East Tennessee Street in Evansville, Indiana. He had been living at Rescue House, a halfway house for prisoners, ever since he had been taken off Vandenberg County's work release program. Schiro had been arrested for rape, but never convicted, even though he had been convicted of other crimes. Somehow, his arrest record got lost in the shuffle when he had been released and assigned to the halfway house in Evansville. He had been accused of raping a 17-year-old girl from Mount Carmel, Indiana, in 1978, but the charges had been dropped. Rescue House Director Ken Hood was to say later that if he had known that Schiro was a sex offender, he never would have allowed him into his program. But in September of 1980, nobody seemed to know, even though by his own reckoning, Schiro had committed 19 or 20 rapes by then. Schiro was also an alcoholic and a drug addict, and his efforts at rehabilitation during late 1980 and early 1981 were focused on getting these two addictions under control. He was attending AA meetings and seemed to be making progress in that area. Unfortunately, he had another addiction for which no program yet existed. Schiro was addicted to pornography as well. According to Mary Lee, whom he met in May of 1979, and with whom he lived until June of 1980, when he went to jail, Schiro was never without pornography. She felt, in fact, that he couldn't live without it, no more than he could live without masturbating, which he did on the average of 10 or 12 times a day. In fact, over the years, a certain pattern of behavior had evolved in Schiro, of which the drugs and the pornography were integral parts. It seemed, Mary Lee said, that whenever he started looking at the books, he had to get high. Again, pre-internet, even pre-VCR. So printed material is all you get for pornography, maybe photos. And whenever he looked at the books and got high, he and Lee's words went out at night. Schiro had been a voyeur since the age of 12. He had a peeping route in the way that others his age had paper routes. He would find certain residences, usually basement apartments, and ascertain the sleeping habits of the people who lived there. Then he would stand outside their windows and masturbate as he watched them sleep or make love. It was only a matter of time before he was climbing through the windows to rape the women inside, according to the fantasies he had generated from the various pornographic magazines he owned. Schiro returned from jail in the fall of 1980, dried out, but soon his old habits returned. He felt that having a job entitled him to the things he enjoyed, and so the pornography gradually began to make its return. And with the pornography came the whole train of pornography-related behavior. Pornography, then the pot, then the booze, and then masturbation, and then he would go out at night. At first he would go out only once a month, but his habit built up gradually. Everything was just like being on a slide, Mary Lee said. You know, it was real fast. It was from once a month to once a week, to twice a week, and then by November it was every night. Schiro's behavior was a function of pornography. Pornography got him drinking, and once he was drunk and his inhibitions were lowered, he felt compelled to act out the fantasies he had seen in the X-rated bookstores. When Schiro and Mary Lee moved to Evansville, his behavior got worse. He began to beat her, at one point knocking her two front teeth out. By the late fall of 1980, he was all but out of control. When Lee was at work, Shira would take her 2-year-old son, Willie, to the Evansville Mall and use him as a prop for panhandling, saying that he needed the money to feed his child. He would then take the money and spend it at adult bookstores. Sometimes he would spend $20 on one session at what he called the quarter movies. These were the peep shows at the adult bookstores. For a quarter, Shiro could see 2 or 3 minutes of a 15-minute film loop. The contents of the quarter movies were generally the most hardcore of all the offerings at the adult bookstores. When Mary Lee once asked Shiro where he had got the idea for that particularly bizarre form of sexual behavior, he answered by saying that he had learned it from these film strips. In early December, Shiro told his employer at Tri-State Repair, Robert Wheeler, that he had seen one of the women living at the house across the street come out to get the mail clad only in a pajama top and panties. The scene was the type of thing that Shiro never forgot. Over the next 2 months, the image sank into his pornography-saturated psyche and emerged later as a fantasy that demanded action. He had made up his mind that he was going to rape the woman who lived across the street from where he worked. By February 4, the fantasy had become irresistible. According to the testimony of Mary Lee, Shiro said that when he woke up, he just knew that something was wrong. He said the feeling got stronger and stronger, that he became afraid that something bad was going to happen. Shiro spent the day of February 4, 1981, slowly being drawn into his own pornography-inspired obsessions. He was being inexorably transformed into an actor in his own quarter movie. Throughout the day on the job, Shiro intoxicated himself by inhaling an industrial solvent. After leaving work at 2:30 in the afternoon, he went to a local tavern where he stole a pint of whiskey. He then took the whiskey to an X-rated bookstore and consumed it as he initiated his ritual of perusing first the magazines and then working his way back to the hardcore quarter movies. Dr. Frank Osenka, a psychologist who specializes in child abuse and pornography, testified at Shiro's trial that the quarter movies were in general more sadomasochistic, more rape-oriented, and more violent than the generic movies at adult bookstores. As Shiro became more intoxicated, his behavior became correspondingly more belligerent. At one point he ran out of quarters and went for change, exposing himself to the cashier. The woman attendant gave him his change, and he went back and purchased more movie time. The next time he ran out of quarters, he returned to the cashier, still exposed, but this time was belligerent about it. This time the woman threw him out. At this point, he began making his way toward a house at 1210 Tennessee Street to keep his appointment with a woman who had gone out to get the mail in her pajama top and panties. He never found her. He found her roommate instead. Laura Jane Lubehusen, had put on a robe for the evening. She was having a mixed drink and watching television, planning to take a bath and then go to bed. She had moved to Evansville from Ferdinand, Indiana, a small town 50 miles off to the northeast. She worked as a truck driver for Charles Chips. She was a lesbian and living with a younger, prettier woman Shiro had seen from his workplace. Her name was Darlene Hooper. She worked as a hostess at the Executive Inn in Evansville. She had been married and, in fact, was to spend the night of February 4 with her ex-husband. There is evidence that the lesbian relationship between Hooper and Lubehusen was threatening to break up. In a note found in the trash can after the murder, Lubehusen wrote to Hooper, "Honey, I do love you, and I don't want to leave either, so what we have to do is quit fighting. I love you, Laura." At 9:30 p.m., damn, he's painting the scene. Shiro knocked in the... "Can I use your bathroom?" At 9:30 p.m., Shiro knocked on the door of 1210 East Tennessee. "My car broke down," he said to Lubehusen. "Can I use your phone? I want to call my dad." "Sure," said Laura Jane, and she let him into the house. Had Mary Lee had the benefit of reading the Lockhart Commission report, she would have known that, quote, "exposure to erotica had no impact upon moral character," and that, quote, "the increased availability of explicit sexual materials, in Denmark at least, has been accompanied by a decrease in the incidence of sexual crime." She also might have learned that, quote, "available research indicates that sex offenders have had less adolescent experience with erotica than other adults." In sum, she would have learned that, quote, "empirical research designed to clarify the question has found no evidence to date that exposure to explicit sexual materials plays a significant role in the causation of delinquent or criminal behavior among youth or adults. Since Mary Lee did not have the benefit of reading the Lockhart Commission report, she ended up doing empirical research of her own, and this entailed getting beaten repeatedly and having her two front teeth knocked out, as Shiro's behavior degenerated into the savagery that pornography-generated passions create. Her testimony contains firsthand observation of how pornography inspires behavior by arousing the passions to the point where they are no longer under rational control. Now, do you recognize the problem here? I mean, there's billions of people who've seen pornography, but a tiny, tiny fraction only acts like this. So he's basically just blithely proceeding as if you look at some porno magazines, you're going to be driven to this kind of behavior, but yet it happens rarely. Or what irritates me more than that is that he doesn't make any formal argument. He just, you know, this is anecdotal stuff. Mary Lee observed the same pattern, quote unquote, which began with the pornographic film loops, followed by liquor and dope, and then deviant sexual behavior. Once the pattern got established, it was impossible to predict Shiro's behavior. Like if we would be talking, having a conversation or watching TV or something, all of a sudden he'd be really angry, like I had said something he didn't like, or I don't know, but just a boom, and he was mad. It was unpredictable moments like that that Mary got her two front teeth knocked out. At another point, Shiro gave her bruised ribs and a black eye. At another point, he bit her and then chased her down the street. It was horrible, she recounted to the court. It was like he was possessed. It was almost an inhuman laugh, and he kept saying, "You can't get away from me." In his more lucid moments, Shiro seemed aware that he had become the thrall of his own disordered passions. During one of his assaults on Mary Lee, he would repeat to her, "You are making me do this. I don't want to do this, but I can't stop, and you are making me do this." Lee's testimony gives a graphic account of the bondage that pornography creates in its victims. Again, the problem is that tens of millions of people have seen pornography, and what percentage of them act like this? But he just simply states pornography creates a bond in its victims. He knew that people said it was wrong, and he knew that someone who was normal didn't do these things, and he didn't want to do them. He just couldn't stop, though. Something would get inside of him, and there he would go. He had no control over it, though, because he hated doing it. He would cry and say, "Why do I do these things? Help me stop. What can I do to quit this? I don't want to do this anymore." He wanted to be like the guy next door, you know, with the car and the garage and the dog. "I hate the things that he had done, but I can't say I hate Tom because I know that he is sick." He couldn't stop doing the things he did. So evidently, if you look at pornography, you lose your free will. The same pattern repeated itself in the encounter with Laura Jane. After gaining entrance to the house by lying about his car, Shiro persuaded her to have consensual intercourse. Then, after waking, he became enraged at her for no apparent reason and began beating her over the head with first a bottle and then an iron. Laura Jane continued to struggle until Shiro strangled her. Then he dragged her into the living room of the house and sodomized her corpse. While doing this, he was, according to Lee's testimony, crying the whole time, saying, "God, please help me stop. Don't let me do this. Please help me, God. I just can't quit." So there you go. The guy was made probably even a religious believer, and he did this. And I would bet you that the religiously inclined who get into pornography are probably more likely to do that kind of thing than the atheist types who are into pornography. Or I bet there's no difference between them. Because the type of person who's going to do this thing is often going to be not all that intelligent, and since they don't have the ability to control themselves, the type of people who are like that are, I'm wrestling with my demons. They're the type of people who say stuff like that, rather than just take responsibility for what they're doing. And who is it who talks about demons and how demons are out there trying to trap you? Why, it's religion. It's not atheists talking about that. Shiro's trial received some attention at the time of the Meese hearings on pornography in the mid-80s. In general, however, the testimony of those whose addiction to pornography led to murder and other crimes was generally suppressed by the media, which sought to portray masturbation to pornography as not only harmless, but also as an expression of freedom. that plays into their other goals of swapping out real political speech, calling that hate speech, to ban opinions they don't like, and substituting cheap filler of pornography, which has nothing to do with free speech. Something similar happened to the testimony of mass murderer Ted Bundy, who told Dr. James Dobson hours before Bundy was executed that pornography led him to do what he did. You know, maybe he thought Dobson wanted to hear that as well. You got to take that into account. The editor of the Evansville newspaper told me after handing me a copy of Shiro's autobiography that pornography had no effect on behavior, even though Shiro and his girlfriend said the exact opposite. This suppression of the truth continues for a number of reasons. First of all, because the publishing industry is now heavily involved in pornography, and it is not in their interest to explain to the public that they are in the business of enslaving people. Secondly, the great myth of the Enlightenment is liberation. If it could be shown that the sexual liberation brings about bondage, then those who use the term to their advantage would be powerless to control their behavior. Finally, no one wants to admit that passions can get out of control because it contradicts the central Promethean myth of the Enlightenment. Just as Ben Franklin harnessed electricity for mankind's benefit, so the sexual revolutionaries have liberated sexual energy from the moral law for the same end. To say that, quote, liberated, unquote, passions were imperious masters who enslaved those who unleashed them. But again, this is typical of leftist dishonesty. There's an undistributed middle. Really? Well, why don't we have tens of millions of people who are bonded to their out-of-control passions and who are running around raping and murdering people? We don't have that. You see the fundamental dishonesty there? I mean, he's begging the question. Well, yeah, you can point to one or two people who do it just the same as he does with Protestantism in general and claims that, oh, once you ditch the church, you're going to be sexually licentious. But he doesn't address that the people who, that although he can cite examples of that, what about the people who aren't like that, like the Mennonites and the Amish, who believe basically the same thing? They're the same, more or less the same permutation or variation of the doctrines he's saying produce all this garbage. And yet they're more morally regular than any group of Catholics you care to find. I guarantee you that. So, you know, no one is doubting that it can, people, it's just like alcohol or anything else, people can abuse it. Does that mean that it's inherently going to lead to this? He's more or less saying that without saying it, like that blowout haired guy of the meme, you know, is it aliens? I'm not saying it was aliens, but it's aliens. Not saying that looking at a pinup girl is going to turn you into a sadomasochistic necrophiliac corpse grower, but I'm kind of saying that. You see what I'm saying? This is, in my opinion, Jones at some of his worst. Because if not his worst, no, it's actually what he does all the way through. So it's not his worst, but it's just where it comes closest to being obviously ridiculous. You know? Now, let's see. Lost my place here. Okay, so he's going through why the publishing industry doesn't want to tell you what sexual liberation and widespread pornography can mean, or at least mean for some people. 13 hours after Shiro arrived at the door, Darlene Hooper discovered Laura Jane's battered body just inside the front door of their house on the living room floor. Rigor mortis had set in. The body's face and hair were covered with blood. A blood-stained pair of jeans was lying a few feet away. A ski jacket and insulated undershirt were pulled up around the neck of the victim, who had been raped while alive, beaten over the head with a whiskey bottle and an iron, and then strangled. The body had also been raped and sodomized after death. Given Shiro's state of mind and given the internal logic of pornography, it was only a matter of time until somebody got killed. Death runs like a leitmotif through all pornographic practice. Necrophilia is only the logical extension of the tendencies already there. There are those who get killed by asphyxiating themselves while masturbating. There are those who murder their victims, particularly children, because they are afraid of getting caught. There are those who accidentally kill their victims in the process of some bondage routines. And there are those like Shiro who, according to psychologist Franco Sanka, saw just enough of the simulated sex and murder situations that he just had to try it himself. in my opinion, while the pornography may have led him to whatever particular things he did, someone that weak-minded is going to be laid low by any of the myriad temptations that face all of us. After several times in my interview with him, Osanka continued, I finally concluded that he knew he was going to kill this woman when he went in there, and so I just said to him, did you intend to kill her? And he said, yes. He was fairly consistent on that, and that when I asked why, he would say that he had never done that before. Thomas Shiro's behavior could be predicted from the type of pornography he had internalized. His life paralleled the trajectory which pornography had traveled since his birth in 1961. Sometime during 1967, the same year the Lockhart Commission on Obscenity and Pornography was formed, six-year-old Tom Shiro discovered some films owned by his father. One of them was called Bedtime. It was a World War II vintage pornography film. Accounts on how Shiro became acquainted with the film vary. Shiro claims his father showed it to him. The father claims that Shiro discovered it on his own. One thing is certain. Once Shiro saw the film, he never forgot it. It never lost its fascination for him. In fact, when he moved in with Mary Lee 14 years later, he insisted on showing it to her. She remembers it as an old film that was broken into a million pieces. I think he said it came from World War II, but he said he had been looking at it for years. According to Osanka, O-S-A-N-K-A, Bedtime is a film that depicts a man and a woman in bed in various acts of sexual involvement. The significant point of the film is that the camera keeps coming back to the woman's face. The woman's face consistently is one in which she is looking as if she is feeling uncomfortable, and she is looking as if she is in pain, and she is looking as if that this is a disagreeable experience, and at the same time her body is reacting in enthusiastic fashion. The fact that the camera kept going back and forth between the genital contact and her face gives the impression that her body was so enthusiastic in the sexual context, but her face was distorted or angry or in pain, so you get the impression that she's enjoying pain from the sex. It was a lesson in sex education that young Shiro never forgot. When pressed on the issue of the woman's face, Osanka conceded that she could be conveying distaste or even boredom as much as pain. The point is that the six-year-old Shiro was confronted with material he had no way of understanding. There was nothing in his experience that could act as a check on his conclusions. There was no one to interpret the film as a sordid simulacrum of the real meaning of human sexuality. The film became the explicator of sex for Shiro. This lesson was only confirmed later on as Shiro became exposed to progressively more violent and perverted examples of pornography. The stimulus was so powerful it caused Shiro to act in a certain way, causing life to imitate art. Once Shiro internalized the film as his first most powerful lesson in sex education, his behavior became a self-fulfilling prophecy. Sex meant violation and pain, but Shiro concluded that the victim enjoyed the experience nonetheless. Shiro's experience, once he began to act out his fantasies, only confirmed him in his pornography-nurtured view of sex. According to Osanka, what has occurred with Tom happens in many pedophiliacs, that is, the individuals who habitually abuse children, that is, that he had a psycho-sex drive halting as a result of premature, unguided exposure to erotica before he was physically or psychologically ready to integrate that into his personality. Much of his subsequent sexual behavior, sexual aggression, is repetitive of the film. For example, peeping here is not a great deal different between peeping in windows, which are a screen, and masturbating and watching a film and masturbating. Jones again. Shiro's life provides a textbook-like illustration of the trajectory that pornography addiction takes in an individual's life. Shiro's life became a quest for erotic materials, from nudist-type picture magazines of the type one would find in drugstores, to sneaking into X-rated drive-in theaters, where he could watch the sadomasochistic movies and snuff movies in which people are portrayed as being killed through sexual assault. According to testimony to Osanka, Shiro enjoyed these movies immensely, taking particular pleasure in the pain he could see in the victims' faces. Shiro came of age when the stream of pornography in this country was increasing to a flood tide. It was his misfortune to be swept away by it, and the misfortune of his victims to be swept away with him. Shiro saw his first hardcore sadomasochistic film in 1971 at the age of 11. As with Bedtime, he could retain the details of what he saw years afterward. He recounted to Osanka at least 10 years later scenes of extreme violence, women being raped and knifed, men being flagellated. It was obvious to Osanka that he enjoyed recalling these particular scenes. They are important to him, the psychologist told the court during Shiro's trial, because of the disorder he is suffering. He is overpowered by this need for orgasmic release, which he had conditioned and developed over a period of years, and the only release is through more and more bizarre forms of masturbation. For example, in relating the number of rapes and the specifics of the rapes, he would very often say that by the time he broke into a home, he would not have an erection, and so he would have to lie on the floor and use his picture books in order to be able to get an erection, in order to be able to go into the next room to start the ritual of hovering over the body of the victim, in order to ejaculate in the face of the victim. The whole practice of ejaculating onto the victim is a recurring theme in pornography today. He very specifically likes those parts of the films when he watches the peep shows. Shiro was by no means only indebted to hardcore material as his educator in depravity. He claimed that he learned the technique for breaking into homes to commit rapes from the made-for-television movie called Cry Rape. The crucial fact of Shiro's life was that pornography influences behavior. It functions as an aid to masturbation. Even more significant, though, is the fact that when these pornographic images got incorporated into Shiro's masturbatory fantasies, they demanded to be acted out. Acting out is the only way that the addict can find the stimulation he needs to complete his act of masturbation. According to Osanka, most people who look at pornography over any extended period of time masturbate in conjunction with the material. People don't masturbate to train magazines or baseball magazines, but they do to pornography magazines. What happens is that the masturbation, coupled with the visual image, places the individual in the situation to the point where in some people, it goes past fantasy to the point where people really believe that they can achieve those types of thing, and there's an increased desire for acting them out. Since he started so early, all sexuality is masturbation to Shiro. Without the women he'd rape, he'd have a hard time unless he was masturbating. Edward Donnerstein, an authority on pornography and sexual aggression, testified at Shiro's trial that, quote, there is a direct link between exposure to certain types of pornography, particularly images that are aggressive in nature, in fact, images which Mr. Shiro was exposed to very, very early and found very sexually stimulating, and increases in calloused attitudes about rape, increases in the belief that women desire and enjoy being raped, and increases in willingness, in fact, to say one would commit rape, and also increases in aggressive behavior against women. Mr. Shiro believes, in fact, the victim finds these types of aggressive acts very pleasurable. According to Donnerstein, or Stein, I don't know, Shiro viewed pornography which showed rapes of women, pornography which showed sadistic acts against women and against men, and pornography which is showing masochistic, very aggressive types of acts, and he consistently said in interviews that he finds those very, very sexually arousing, so sexually arousing, particularly in the instances where he was drinking, that he literally wanted to, if he could, rip the page out and rape the woman or have intercourse with a woman on the page, but since he couldn't, he would seek out an unwilling victim. Kind of reminds me of a Bible idiot trying to go from the Bible to what's outside his window and see all the portents and signs. You know, there's a certain types of people that just can't make a distinction between reality and fantasy. In spite of its flaws and the fact that the Congress which brought the commission into being rejected its findings, the Lockhart Commission report was widely disseminated throughout the liberal media establishment as proof, quote-unquote, that pornography was harmless. The recommendation that existing laws be repealed, along with the fact that prosecution of obscenity cases virtually ceased, created the impression in the public mind that the obscenity laws had, in fact, been repealed. Clive Barnes, epitomizing the liberal reaction of the commission and the very act of disseminating its results, could conclude that, quote, women are the underprivileged sex when it comes to erotica, and that this underprivilege derives from male supremacy. The conclusion was that more smut would make America a better place. It wasn't long before evidence to the contrary started showing up. In 1973, the Stag film went public with the widespread dissemination of the X-rated film Deep Throw. The film's main character, Linda Lovelace, who you've heard about in an earlier chapter, became an overnight celebrity in articles in the liberal press that tried to bring respectability to a woman performing deviant acts on the wide screen. Nora Ephron, as she's a Jew, wrote an article in which she quoted Lovelace as saying, "I totally enjoyed myself making the movie. I don't have any inhibitions about sex. I just hope everybody who goes to see the film loses some of their inhibitions." Lovelace, after escaping her pimp-cum-manager, later described her descent into what used to be called white slavery in less flattering terms. Throughout the 70s, it was becoming increasingly apparent that giving free rein to sex meant that sex would quickly devolve into something else. By the 70s, sadomasochism had become so prevalent that it was used as part of an advertising campaign to sell records for the Rolling Stones. "I'm black and blue from the Rolling Stones, and I love it," said a lady on a billboard in Hollywood with ropes around her arms and bruises on her thighs. It was becoming increasingly clear that sex was not stopping at just sex. In 1976, the movie Snuff was released, which purported to show a woman being murdered and then dismembered on the screen for the sexual delectation of the viewing audience. The film caused the first large-scale media-approved reaction to pornography since the Lockhart Commission told the world that America would be a better place with more pornography. So again, they get rid of the Hays Code in the late 60s, or mid-60s, and they're already to a snuff film, if fake, 10 years later. Feminists across the country protested the movie. In San Francisco in 1978, feminists organized a Take Back the Night march through San Francisco's pornography district. In New York, in 1979, biweekly tours of 42nd Street were being offered by an organization known as Women Against Pornography. Andrea Dworkin, a Jew feminist, lesbian, extreme uggo, and Catherine A. McKinnon, a non-Jew extreme Puritan, attempted to have ordinances passed in Indianapolis and Minneapolis which would make pornography illegal because it violated women's rights. And I think Dworkin said, like, all heterosexual sex is rape, and Catherine McKinnon basically wanted to do classic SJW. Some of you may be too young to remember her, but she was a big name in the 80s, I think it was, and you wouldn't have a First Amendment, let's put it that way, if she had her druthers. By the mid-80s, however, it was clear that pornography was an issue that split the feminist movement. A large number of feminists, mostly lesbians, saw nothing wrong with pornography because they used it themselves. McKinnon found herself attacked in the pages of Off Our Backs, a lesbian monthly, commenting on an article on pornography by Alice Henry, which appeared in the November 1984 issue of Off Our Backs. Sharon Page of Chicago applauds the author in the journal, quote, "for breaking the silence and showing that radical feminists are not, after all, monolithic followers of the McKinnon-Dworkin anti-porn analysis and strategy. Porn slash erotica can play a progressive role in showing the woman taking pleasure apart from the married slash reproductive context, if we reclaim it to do so." Sex positive feminists, they'd call them later. It was the beginning of a strategy which the publishing industry would adopt in the 1990s as a way of diffusing feminist protest against pornography. It's empowering women. That'd be like the Jezebel motif. Of course, Jezebel wasn't around back then. Still pre-internet for the most part here. Andrea Dworkin, who seems to have become deranged by reading too much pornography, was typical of the feminist overreaction, which condemned not only pornography, but sexual intercourse as well as something quintessentially male. Males, according to Dworkin, who's an immense, fat, ugly Jew lesbian, were ipso facto a pathological phenomenon. Pornography was simply the most visible symptom of the disease, in the way that the sore is an indication of herpes. Maleness was the universal radix malorum, root of evil. Terror Dworkin Rights and Pornography, Women Possessing Men, is the outstanding theme and consequence of male history and male culture. Terror issues forth from the male, illuminates his essential nature and his basic purpose. According to Dworkin, there was virtually no difference between rape and marriage. Quote, marriage is an institution developed from rape as a practice. Rape, originally defined as abduction, became marriage by capture. Marriage meant the taking was to extend in time, to be not only use of, but lifelong possession of or ownership. As with most feminist analysis, Dworkin's views preclude the need for explanation. Shiro, one could say, was a rapist because he was male. Pornography just allowed his maleness free expression. Men exploited women sexually because they were men. Exploitation exists because men exist, and so on. The belief that sexual perversion and exploitation and pornography were all a function of maleness is, however, becoming less tenable in the face of the evidence. First of all, feminists, especially lesbians, are increasingly frequent users of pornography. One need only read the book ads for Lambda Press and Naiad Press to find this out. Naiad Press, in fact, had no qualms about selling the rights to a number of the stories in its bestseller, Lesbian Nuns, to the unabashedly pornographic Forum magazine, which was owned by Penthouse, one of the big three of one-handed magazines. A new lesbian journal, On Our Backs, makes use of the standard undoctored sadomasochistic material. As a result, and as has already happened to the heterosexual and male homosexual demimonde, life is beginning to imitate art. Gloria Kaufman, a South Bend feminist, writing in the May 1985 issue of Off Our Backs, explained how she sent two young recruits to the feminist movement to the Michigan Women's Music Festival for what she, quote, supposed would be an edifying experience. Unfortunately, the recruits stumbled upon the festival's sadomasochism workshop, where they saw, quote, a group of women in leather standing over another woman on the ground, lacerations and blood all over her body and blood all over the ground. Kaufman then finds herself confronted with what seems like a contradiction in the feminist movement. How is it, she asked, that we disapprove of men's cutting up women, but we tolerate women's cutting up of women? Kaufman takes pride in the pluralism of feminism. She has heard the arguments of the SM crowd, but remains unconvinced. S&M people, she opines, will tell you that the bleeding is superficial and controlled. That is not reassuring. Kaufman's greatest fear, though, is that the S&M crowd will give lesbianism a bad name. Since the practitioners of S&M are lesbians, she argues with a logic difficult to refute, it validates homophobia in the minds of some non-lesbian feminists. Homophobia based upon irrational fear is difficult, but possible to combat. Homophobia based upon knowledge of real-life sadism is exceedingly difficult, perhaps impossible to eradicate. The facts, in other words, are the best argument in support of homophobia. And Jones never questions words. He uses the words that the people he criticizes use without putting them in tweezers, as it were. So, it's not my way of doing things. I would question it and attack it, but he doesn't do that. I mean, homophobia is an inherently invalid concept, is what I would say at that point, but he never gets into that kind of analysis. Lest her lesbian readership conclude that she has gone too far in the direction of intolerance, Kaufman makes it clear that she is only opposed to the public display of women lacerating other women. Let it be clear that I am calling to question no one's expression of sexuality in the privacy of her home. The belief that deviant sexual behavior of the sort portrayed in pornographic films and practiced at the Michigan Women's Sick Music Festival, WOMYN, that was a neologism they used back then that, unlike Ms., didn't catch on, can remain within limits and thereby ensure that no one will get hurt has been the cornerstone for the liberal apologia for the dissemination of pornography. Tom Shiro grew up against this background of ever-deepening decadence, went from being a masturbator to a voyeur, to a rapist, to a murderer, in following one clearly defined trajectory that anyone who is familiar with the themes pornography portrayed over the past 10 years should have been able to predict. Okay, but if you take 100 million people who have seen pornography, how many will follow that trajectory to the end, or even more than the first step? That's the relevant question. If one considers how he ended up, Shiro's early years are remarkable for their absence of pathology. Shiro was adopted at the age of 5 days. His foster parents did not divorce, nor was Shiro the victim of child abuse of either the physical or sexual variety. In fact, the opposite seemed to be the case. If anything, Shiro was spoiled as a child. Quote, "Ever since I can remember," he wrote in a 39-page autobiography after he was arrested, "Mommy and Daddy have given me everything I wanted. I always got what I wanted. My birthday is 2 days before Christmas, so I get double the presents. I got 14 bikes in 13 years. When Shiro didn't want to do something, he didn't do it. If he didn't want to go to school, he'd pretend that he was sick. The nurse used to try to tell me I wasn't sick, but I'd start crying because I knew Mommy would come and get me, and she did." Much has been written contributing to the mystification of rape, most of it by feminists. It is, according to them, the expression of the male reign of terror over females. In her much-cited book, Against Our Will, feminist Susan Brown Miller makes out of rape a cosmic principle, block quote. "Man's discovery that his genitalia could serve as a weapon to generate fear must rank as one of the most important discoveries of prehistoric times, along with the use of fire and the first crude stone axe. From prehistoric times to the present, I believe rape has played a critical function. It is nothing more or less than a conscious process of intimidation by which all men keep all women in a state of fear." When one examines the actual life of an actual rapist, the explanations seem less cosmic and seem to have more to do with human passion left to grow wild under the unnatural stimulation of pernicious influences like pornography and drugs. When Mary Lee described Shiro's sexual practices to the court, she gave some insight into how a deranged sexuality of the sort described in and fostered by pornography could lead in itself to rape. "He would just get on and pump away," Lee said of their love life, "until he was finished and then get off. I would try to say no, but he never took no for an answer." A rapist, in other words, is someone who never takes no for an answer. Tom Shiro was propelled through life by pornography-incited fantasies, which became more and more bizarre and more imperious as time went on. His addictions to drugs and alcohol simply made him more likely to act out the scenarios he spent so much time viewing. And once he acted out one scenario, the craving was set in motion to act out another, more bizarre one, further down the road. "I remember going to bookstores," he wrote, describing one of his earlier memories, "and looking at girly books or photography books and hoping they'd have naked pictures in them. I started peeping in windows. It was exciting. I started smoking pot in 7th grade. I always cried a lot, especially about not having friends." Shiro received little moral guidance from his father. After being caught peeping and picked up by his father at the police station, Shiro remembers his father saying, "If you want something to screw, why didn't you ask me? We'll get you a hooker or something, rather than peeping in windows." In spite of the embarrassment he caused his family, Shiro was once again not punished. "I don't think I got him put on restriction or anything," Shiro added. Psychologist Frank Osenka felt that Shiro got caught up in bad habits, which involved a necessary progression from one phase to the other. Block quote here from Osenka. "Getting access to girly magazines that are readily available led to seeing in the girly magazines ads for other kinds of material, and then to seeking those out. In the past, that meant as a youngster sneaking into X-rated drive-ins, or, as Shiro did, to somehow team up with another adult who had these kinds of materials and getting sexually involved with them, as Shiro did, to eventually getting into the adult bookstores. There's a progression of severity and increase in bizarreness of material, which I think is dangerous, but today it's not even necessary to go through all those steps. Today there is such a widely available triple X-rated material at video rental stores that are not adult bookstores. These are family movie rentals that have the section that sells the X-rated movies." And that's how it was in the maybe the later 80s. Before the internet again, still. "And many of those movies have many of the more violent themes that were only available in adult bookstores." So again, the VCR changed things before the internet changed things. When asked what the most significant change in pornography was since the Lockhart Report of the Commission on Obscenity and Pornography, Father Morton Hill, S.J., that means he's a Jesuit, cited the expansion of pornography into other media, most notably the home video cassette business, VHS and VCR. Given the type of practices one becomes accustomed to watching in pornography and the habit of masturbation that invariably accompanies such viewing, it should come as no surprise that the addict sees no magic line separating what the liberals would call private behavior from rape. Shiro took to rape as the natural extension of his already perverted sex life. He had learned not to take no for an answer. Well, I mean, why couldn't you say that was the cause of it? As much as the pornography. His parents never said no to him, so he assumed that he could have whatever he wanted and wouldn't take no for an answer. He couldn't say no to himself. Why should he take that answer from other people? It was in April of 1977 that we moved to Indiana, he wrote in his autobiography. Then I started mainlining cocaine. I started peeping in windows again in Princeton. I didn't have a real friend. Everybody thought I was a fool and had a big mouth. When I try to pay people a compliment, it would always come out as an insult. I don't know how many girls I screwed in Princeton. Maybe 8. I don't know where the idea of rape came in, but it excited me. One night I went over to Mount Carmel and peeped in windows to look for a naked girl to rape. I found her. Before this, I'd always go around in my car and masturbate. I'd stop girls along the road and ask them for directions someplace. It was like a compulsion. I couldn't stop myself. I did it so many times. It was an everyday thing. It excited me. Shiro then describes the mixed feelings he got from exposing himself. It was so exciting. I don't know how I felt. I know I was out of my mind. I was always scared of getting caught, but I couldn't stop. I was scared. I remember after each time I did these things, I said to myself, "My God, what have I done?" I couldn't stop myself. According to the catharsis theory propounded by the Lockhart Commission, Shiro should have been content to look at his pornographic films and books and masturbate in private. It didn't work out that way, and the proponents of pornography have yet to come up with an explanation of why. But the opponents, you could say, they could say on the other hand, well, you have to come up with an explanation of why 99.999999% of pornography viewers don't act the way Shiro did, since you're saying that's the cause. But again, it's sort of a Catholic type of reasoning. If you can convert 1 out of 1,000, that proves the other 999 could convert as well. But if 999 out of 1,000 don't convert, why, that proves nothing. I do not exaggerate. That is very definitely Catholic reasoning, and it's distinct from actual reasoning. Now, let's see. And also keep in mind that they believe in free will. But all of a sudden, you know, you lose your free will, and now you're in bondage, you're a thrall to your own desires. Well, free will doesn't turn on and off. The answer transcends the categories, even of good psychologists, because it has to do with the nature of sexuality itself, which is intrinsically other-directed. If it is not directed toward a spouse and put at the service of life, it will be directed toward people who have been turned into objects, and then it will head toward death. The Reverend Richard Roach, S.J., again Jesuit, a moral theologian at Marquette University, sees sex as an either-or situation. Denial of its God-ordained purpose leads inevitably to the depravity which has been so adequately documented in recent years. Block quote. When sex is moved from the authentic conjugal expression, that would mean within a marriage, you really introduce sadomasochism, because the very physical structure of sex gives a dominant and penetrating figure and submissive and penetrated figure, no matter how active the woman is. And that very physical structure is potentially sadomasochistic. Sex can be used as put down. All of that element is redeemed in authentic conjugal love. And that's why authentic conjugal love is, in the long run, the only sex that is consoling. And that other element remains in all illicit sex in varying degrees. You're using the other person to want to hurt them if you're not conjugally committed to them. is the argument. Now, in homosexuality, it is immediately present in a very large degree, even at the early romantic stage of homosexuality, because one has to artificially or wrongly submit to the other or do things that are disgusting for this pleasure, even if it's traded back and forth. So there's a megapotency for sadomasochism. The very anatomical and psychological structure of sex is potentially that at all times and is redeemed only by the honest-to-God structure of conjugal love for which it was made. And that's the end of that block quote. And we're on the last page here now, just starting it. As Shiro became more deeply immersed in pornography, his behavior became more and more overtly sadistic. He beat up his girlfriend, Mary Lee, a number of times in the months leading up to the murder. He would repeatedly drown and revive Lee's son, Willie, in their bathtub. Shiro also developed a relationship with a mannequin in an Evansville department store window. Hey, baby, what's going on? You're looking good today. He would tell her his problems and at one point became very upset when her wig was changed. He even asked the mannequin for permission to marry Mary Lee. Now, are you going to tell me this guy was driven to this by pornography? He was just a fucking nut from the word go, is my opinion. In retrospect, psychologist Osanka feels that this behavior, along with his instructions to Lee that she should not move during sex, indicated an increasing attraction to necrophilia. That means sex with the dead. And if you work, and if you don't, just don't. Just don't. Shiro at one point indicated an interest in working in a funeral home so that he could have sexual relations with dead bodies. Sex with the dead was the one thing that Shiro hadn't tried, and the idea of it became an obsession with him, so much so that according to Osanka, he knew that he was going to kill his next victim. The one thing that remained constant in Shiro's slide toward the ultimate violation was his constant use of pornography. It was the gas that fueled his obsession. When I met Mary, he wrote, after the first month of living together, I used to get my girly books and look at them while we screwed. I would make believe I was screwing the girls in the book. It was exciting. Mary would like to watch my face. I don't think she really liked me doing it. Girly books excite me so much. I've always looked at them. I can remember when I get horny from looking at girly books and watching girly shows, I'd want to go rape somebody. Every time I'd masturbate, I'd be thinking of rape and the women I had raped, remembering how exciting it was, the pain in their faces, the thrill, the excitement. The connection between illicit sex and death is the last thing the propagandists for sexual revolution would admit, but it's been there all along. Tom Shiro had to find out the hard way. The tragic linkage of male homosexual activity to suicide is well known. While exact numbers are hard to come by, the rate of suicide among the homosexually active seems to be 20 or more times higher than in the general population. As abortion has shown, a sex-saturated culture quickly becomes one obsessively concerned with death. The only way Shiro could satisfy his increasingly bizarre, imperious sexual desires was through closer and closer approximations until finally it was death alone that would satisfy him, and one young woman's life was the price he was willing to pay for sexual satisfaction. Shiro has been on death row in the Indiana State Penitentiary at Michigan City since 1982. He continues to masturbate 10 or 12 times a day, now to metal images of the dead body of the woman he murdered. His life is one never-ending cycle of tumescence and remorse, lived out, appropriately enough, on death row. And that's the end of the story of Tom Shiro and the broader lessons it does or doesn't teach, depending on how much you want to believe of Jones's thesis. I thank you for being with me today and through this whole journey. And I say to you that I will be back with you shortly with part 3, chapter 20. Good day.